And my mom walked by at that time and she said to me, have you thought about what you're going to study in school? Are you going to go into the family business? Are you going to be a doctor, a lawyer, blah, blah, blah. And I looked up at her on the floor, Bruce Lee magazine there, trying to work the front splits. I said, Mom, school is not going to be important in my life because I'm going to be a famous martial artist like Bruce Lee and I'm going to invent my own self-defense system. And she goes, okay, dear. She pats me on the head. She goes, we'll talk about this when you're older.
It's so funny. We have the guy who was Billy Mazur was a retired deputy chief from Atlantic City. I was like, he's like, you want to go for lunch? Because that's what we had on. We did a 2-hour podcast with him, another therapist, and another guy who was a Navy SEAL, Nick Norris, talking about psychotherapy and trauma and all that stuff.
Sure.
And it went later than it did. I actually had a feeling it was going to because we had 4 people on that pod at the same time. And he's like, you want to go to lunch? And I'm like, I can't, dude. I got to do a podcast now. I'm like, you know who Tony Blauer is? He's like, bro, it's a fucking legend. Spear system. And he started doing, he's like, spear system, bro. You go anywhere you can from here. You go for your gun, knife. And then I'm like, yeah, that's Tony.
It's wild. It's funny. I did a podcast yesterday with another gentleman. And some of the stuff, but the people, it freaks me out. Like at your event, which I was blown away by, and I'll hijack the show for a second. For anyone who hasn't gone to the Street Cop event, and Dennis didn't pay me to say this, but I'd never seen so many cops at a conference in my life. And I've been going to conferences for decades. The quality of your speakers, world-class, and getting cops to, because it wasn't hands-on. I mean, it was like, it was all mindset, resilience, like mental health, strategy, psychology. To see that many people taking notes and showing up, and it's a long conference. It's not like a day and a half and everyone's drunk and whatever. So kudos to you and your team. It was fucking amazing. At your event, I had a number of people come up, ex-military, guys from Fieldcraft Survival, and it's going, oh, you know, hey, Tony Blauer, blah, blah, blah. So it was kind of cool. I don't know when this will release, but I turned 63 on Tuesday, on May 2nd. And I
happy
forget,
birthday.
Thanks, buddy. And I forget how many years and decades I've been serving your community and military to the point where I was doing a course. I co-teach this pretty cool event with Michael Chandler, who's fighting Conor McGregor soon, right? So Chandler's a world-class MMA fighter. And we just did this event, our third time doing this seminar together just a couple of weeks ago. And I see they got all these other like big, you know, business speakers at this thing. It's kind of this big mastermind thing. And I do the combative stuff with Chandler. And I see this guy standing there, ex-military looking guy. He looks familiar. So I go over, he's just standing on the side. And I go over, I extend my hand. Hey, I'm Tony Blauer. You know, good to meet you. And he goes, you trained me when I was a SEAL back in. And I get that all the time, man. I get goosebumps when I hear that shit. Anyways, let's talk about me a little bit more. Go ahead. Tell me, say legend again.
He said, bro, he's legendary and handsome. And smells good and a fantastic lover he heard in bed.
Right. Right. Well, it was a little private, but now it's not anymore. But
there's a rumor that you actually can swim in the ocean and wrestle whales. Is that a real thing?
Yeah. That's when I was a unicorn, not a unicorn, a mermaid. And I transitioned recently.
And what can't, I think the Chuck Norris things need to change over to Tony Blauer.
I literally had people do that. We had some a couple years ago, a few years ago, somebody sent a meme like that where I was in the meme, I was kicking Chuck Norris's ass, which is funny. And he's quite an icon and a legend, but those Chuck Norris memes are classic.
How old do you think Chuck Norris is now?
I think I think he's 83.
Come on.
He's good friends with, I'll pull this up right now. He's good friends with a good buddy of mine, Richard Norton. And I think he just posted RJ Norton.
He's 83.
Yeah.
83. Unbelievable.
So here, I don't know if you guys can see this. So the guy beside Norris is a good friend of mine, Richard Norton. Richard Norton's been in movies with...
I know who that is.
Yeah. So, crazy story. In the 80s, I don't even think you were born then, but...
I was born in 81, just so you know.
Oh, shit.
Listen, can I just tell you something? You're saying, holy shit, you should have polled the audience at the conference, because I got to tell you, most people in that audience are born from 97 to about 2004. So don't holy shit yourself just yet, young man.
Dude.
I'm the old guy now at 41 going on 42, just so we're clear.
That's crazy. About 6 or 7 years ago, I was visiting Carlsbad PD, which is all like Spear and High Gear. And I had moved out to California, and don't hold that against me. I'd moved out to California in 2010. And lifelong, I was 50 years old, lifelong dreamed always, you know, be here. So moved out. And we've got the sold out, post certified, all this shit. There's 42 cops in the class. And I'm like, I live 15 minutes from there. So my team's teaching. And I go to pop by to wave like the queen and do a little Q&A. And people are asking me, you know, what do we go do next and what level? And then a guy in the background puts his hand up and he goes, not so much of a question, Mr. Blauer. I just wanted to say that, you know, when I was 16 years old, I saw you in the martial art magazines and I knew I wanted to be a cop. And I can't believe I'm meeting you now. All these, I'm like going, dude, shut up, sit down. Like, don't tell me how young you are, that you, when you were a teenager, you saw me in the magazine. So it's been an amazing career and busier than ever, but also busy creating, doing stuff. So it's exciting.
What does it feel like to be now 63? And when you sit down and reflect back on the life you've led, being a very interesting one.
It's weird. I don't do it enough because I'm kind of like you. Like if we had met 20 years ago, or if you were a contemporary beside me, like it's just go, 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 go. I mean, I make the joke to my, like, I've got, you know, a lot, everyone on my team is younger than me. But I'm always teasing them, like, just try and keep up to me, do your best. Right. Like, you know, like the op tempo that I do stuff at, it's exhausting. And I don't try. I'm not like this. I gotta get this done. I can literally, I have a home office. I can literally put my phone down and go, I got six dogs, and just go sit on the hammock and hang out with the dogs. And so I can turn it off, turn it on. But I always have this ideation. It's like this entrepreneur brain that's always working. And I make the joke that I've decided to slow down in my 60s, Dennis. I'm now only going to work 7 days a week. So there's a buddy of mine that he's a retired Army Ranger and done many tours overseas. JC Glick, I don't know if you know the name JC Glick. He's written a couple of books, but I trained him when he was part of asymmetric warfare, and then he went on and he was, you know, battalion commander and all this stuff. And he brought me in throughout his career. Big, big, big fucking dude. And at our first course, a lot of people like you, I mean, you met me. I made the joke when we first met. I didn't realize how big you were because you only look like 2 inches big on the podcast. but you're a big dude. So JC's like bigger than you, big like athlete. And I'm explaining physiology, startle flinch, weaponize the startle flinch. Hey, it's your biological airbag. I don't care what size you are. This core to extremity movement is the strongest thing that you can do. And so if you're military in a checkpoint, you got your hand on your M4, you're talking to somebody and all of a sudden, boom, he moves on you, or you're a cop inside the reactionary gap going, hey, you got any weapons on you? Anything I need to know? And then the guy goes, well, and he jumps you. The fastest thing you could do is this. And I'm explaining all this. And he's just standing there like this. And you remember the famous line from the original Roadhouse, I thought you'd be bigger. He was just like, so you're saying that'll work against like if you and I did this? And I'm like, oh, fuck, like this is where I get killed and it's my last course. You know, we're in this loft. There's like 20 of these hardcore military dudes. And he just challenged the system in a respectful way. But I realized that I had to fucking hit him hard and do this movement. He had to feel it. But obviously it worked. I'm here. We're still friends. He shared with me this idea, because very often he would ask, this is going back to your question, what's it feel like to have had this career, et cetera. Very often we became friends. And every time we talk, I'd be like, on to the next thing, or frustrated with this, or how come the world's like this, and why don't people get it? And he asked me if I ever pause and think about the journey, the accomplishments, the units and organizations that we've trained. And I looked at him, I said, no, not really. And he said, you should do that. And he shared an exercise called a look back. I don't know if you ever heard the term before. So
I'm ready.
The look back is this idea that you look back, you know, like you tomorrow as an entrepreneur trying to change like law enforcement training and awareness. And I loved the meme you guys just shared about incentives for hiring people versus, hey, tell us you have our back. Tell us you're going to support us. You're going to train us, and you'll have our back if something happens, right? How about that? You know, it's like, hey, I'm going to cheat on you. I'm going to disrespect you, but I'll pay you more money. Like, I don't want to be in that marriage, right?
Right.
And so,
right.
But I'll buy you nice things, but I'm still, you can't trust me worth a shit. And if something better comes along, I'll fucking kick you out. Okay, thanks. So this look back idea is like you're going 100 miles an hour, and let's say a deal falls through, and an employee screws something up. As the CEO, as the entrepreneur, we're always forward thinking. We're like, fuck, why isn't this computer working? I just bought this new computer. Like, and this look back exercise is this idea that you take your journey, and you try to, as best you can, think about, like, for me, when I was 15 years old, I was looking at a Bruce Lee magazine on the floor, working on the splits, thinking that martial arts would solve all my problems for confidence and self and fear management. And I was all in. I worked out every day. And my mom walked by at that time, and she said to me, have you thought about what you're going to study in school? Are you going to go into the family business? Are you going to be a doctor, a lawyer, blah, blah, blah. And I looked up at her on the floor, Bruce Lee magazine there, trying to work the front splits. I said, Mom, school is not going to be important in my life, because I'm going to be a famous martial artist like Bruce Lee, and I'm going to invent my own self-defense system. And she goes, okay, dear. She pats me on the head. She goes, we'll talk about this when you're older. Like, but I had that feeling like as a 15-year-old. And then I can look at when I was 20, asked to teach my first student, and then working 7 days a week, teaching self-defense at night while I continued to work. I ended up going to my father's company. So I did this look back exercise where it's like, in 1980, I did this. In 1980 and a half, I did this. And then in 82, this happened. 85, this happened. This is 1980. I went to Black Belt Magazine and met Chuck Norris, incidentally, you know, coming out, to my photo shoot. He was walking out. He wasn't as famous then. He had no entourage, right? But I look at all these things, 100 different magazines, from Forbes to Black Belt to SWAT to, you know, blah, blah. But you forget about these things. And it's almost like looking at a photo album of like your kids growing up or you growing up, and you're going, oh my God, I forgot about this. I'm rambling here, but I want to share something important. My wife said to me something yesterday. She said, how is it that no matter how many times I hear you talk about the spear and the sucker punch moment in the 80s and this drill or that drill, you always are animated, you're always intense, how do you not lose your passion for it? Because you've it's like 10,000 times you've told the same stories. And I said, wow, I never even thought about it. It's because as a founder, it's like when you realized your mission, when you're retiring and what you wanted to do, there will never be a time when someone says to you, unless you sell the company and move on, where someone says to you, Dennis, like, why do you do what you do? Why is street cop training important to you? Right? You will never, you could be asleep and within a minute you're going, and then it was, right? And so the look back exercise is something I would recommend everybody do. And I don't know if I answered your question, but I don't do it enough. It's not my nature because I'm always, what's next? When it took years to happen. In 1993, I developed our Hydeer suit. In 2007, the U.S. Army tested it against all other suits, and they bought $17 million worth of my Hydeer. It took 2 years of demos and proof of principle and this or that, but that's a big fucking order, $17 million worth of gear. Literally within 2 weeks of that happening, I had forgotten about it and I was working on the next thing. You know, and that was life-changing in terms of you know, what I was doing as an entrepreneur, as a business people. I set up a 21,000-foot facility. I had 12 staff. I was like, but as soon as that was done, I didn't retire. That entrepreneurial brain just keeps firing.
So people have asked me, you know, how did you feel the conference went? And I feared that the second conference was not going to feel like the first one, and it just didn't. And for good cause, as weird as that sounds, because I think when you do anything for the first time, it's like, you know, that first time, you know, you're always trying to recreate that moment.
Yes.
Where it was so magical. It's like, oh, it was just, can I ever feel that again? Can you ever feel that again? And unfortunately, I can't recreate how the first conference made me feel for many reasons. But I was proud of what we had put on. I recognize and acknowledge what it was this time. The first one was good. This one was, I didn't have a complaint. I'm just like, God damn, I know this thing was fantastic because, you know, the first time we suffered a little criticism. This time I haven't heard one thing that somebody said that was negative at all, which leads me to believe, how do I make the next one better? We did it really, really good. And you know, people are just like, this is the best week of my life. We heard that 1,000 times.
Wow.
The best fucking week of my life. Like, I've never.
Were you, because I couldn't tell, were you a little blasé? Like, were you excited about it? Because I couldn't tell right in the beginning.
I think there are moments few and far between. I think a lot of the, I'm just so into the, this is my job. This is what I do. We are professionals and I have a job to do when I come here. And my job is not to sit there and watch the speakers. My job is to make sure the people that showed up are getting what they were promised and the right experience. So I'm constantly tweaking the dials, like a flight control, person inside of a flight tower, you know, sure, control tower.
Yeah.
Air traffic controller. So, and you know what, like, I think when people start recognizing you in the beginning, it's a lot of, I guess it's new. And you're like, oh my God, this is cool. Like, people like want pictures. They want autographs. But now that's just who I am. And that's my job. And people will ask, and I'm sure from the outside looking in, they're like, oh dude, what's it like to know these guys and spend, you know, going on Tommy Lahren's show while I was there, she's like, hey, can you guys come out and do our show before you leave? I'd love to have you on. And I'm like, yeah, for sure. Doing a show like that 3 years ago, I'd probably be a little worked up and a little nervous.
Sure.
You know, now I walk in and this is just my job now. And so People are getting the professional they expect. And there are moments.
That was your second show?
With her?
No, with the Street Cop. That was only your second conference?
That was our second conference. Yeah.
That's insane. That's insane because it was so big. You know, I've done like 14 years of camps. Every summer we do a combatives camp somewhere. Range between 100, 140 people come, not 1,500 with world-class speakers, with flights and hotels. And why did you pick the hotel Gaylord? Was that something unconscious, Freudian, that you were staying at the Gaylord?
I knew that this is the only way I could track Tony Blauer to come there because it meant something else.
Okay. Meet me at the Gaylord suite.
So I actually asked the question of why is it named the Gaylord? So essentially, the family who originally owned the Gaylord Resorts, their last name was Gaylord. which I'm sure didn't affect them too much when you're billionaire children.
Right.
They essentially sold them to the Marriott, but they don't want to. And it's smart. It's smart business. Why would you change the name if people know exactly where it is and what it is?
Right.
They're a great group to work with. And we listen. I mean, I can reveal some stuff about how we ended up at the Gaylord. And this is all about, you know, how you learn about entrepreneurship is by doing. And, you know, essentially I had an employee that worked here prior and she doesn't work here anymore, who probably wasn't qualified when I leveraged off find me places to have a conference in Nashville.
Right.
At doing the homework. And I later found out there were better options. I just actually talked about this morning, where that decision, we talk about retention of employees that are valuable versus invaluable. The indecision to, you know, move earlier and finding a better candidate ends up costing companies significant funds in the long run. So, you know, if anybody has anxiety of like parting ways, even with a spouse or a friend that, you know, is not right, the long-term cost that you'll pay is tremendous. But I wanted to have it downtown. We ended up at the Gaylord. I'm still happy with what we've got, what we did and how we did it. And what I believed was going to happen actually did, where there were no rooms available.
Right.
At the end, you could not get a room at the in close to the area. And the problem is downtown is a 15, 18 minute ride.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be very accessible.
Ended up having to stay downtown. I couldn't get in.
Right. And that's where I wanted everybody to stay, because downtown has far more options. They have way more options and I think more affordable options in some sense, where we stayed with the Gaylord at the Palms in Orlando for our next one for April 29th through May 4th, 2024. But we're much more comfortable because even though it's a smaller hotel, we're right in the center of like an Icon Park. We're at literally the driveway to Disney.
There's 100 hotels arms reach away.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. So there is just no way on earth this thing's going to sell out. It's impossible. I don't mean the conference itself. I'm saying
the rooms, yeah.
The rooms. There'll be available rooms, which is a big relief. A little different because I like the idea of people being downtown and walking to the venue, not having to worry about rides, where I think that's where a lot of debt, and this is just me being an honest businessman. I think that at the end, people were like, well, I'm not going because I have to drive 15 minutes every time I want to go to this conference. You know, and I got to tell people, like, look, we're trying to give you a great experience, but don't forget what the conference is about. The conference is about you showing up for 5 days and actually getting practical value that's life-changing and career-altering. And then if there's some cool shit that goes on socially, fantastic. And you get an opportunity to spend time with all these people. I mean, dude, Rob O'Neill spent literally the entire lunch break for an hour taking pictures with probably close to almost everybody at that event. Wow. And he didn't have to do it. Wasn't in his contract. And unbeknownst to people that you actually have to pay for that shit with speakers. And they're not. People are like, yo, how do you get these guys? Like, fucking pay them, right? Like, right. I'm not saying that they don't give us a discount because we're law enforcement and they like the cause, but it's not cheap, guys. And usually something like that's an extra $5,000-$10,000 on top of the original speaking fee. And I said to him in the back, you know, what would you like to do with this? And he said, well, I'll say hello. I go, we have a system. We go pretty quickly. This is not our first rodeo.
Right.
We can probably cycle this whole crew through in about an hour. We can make it about 10 seconds a picture. I've timed it before.
Right.
So that's about 6-7 people a minute if we move it fast enough. And I'm doing the math in my head. I'm like, that means we can get to about 7 people a minute times 60 minutes in a minute. It's 1,300. All right, we could probably do a lot of this. And you know, we prepped the crowd and just said, hey, don't be selfish. There's 190 people behind you, 900, 1,000. And let's keep it moving to be fair with everybody. I know you got things to tell Rob O'Neill on how much you want to. And we did this over and over again. And, you know, I got to tell you, these speakers, they, you know, they're just law enforcement community. And they don't have to be, but they are. I just want to give them credit where credit's due. Guys, everybody stuck around and took pictures. It's rare that somebody doesn't.
Yeah, no, it was great. And I was amazed. I can't believe it was your second gig. I started to say before, like I've done, you know, 14, 15 years of annual conferences. What'll happen for you is this. I too have had like an epic experience that I'm going, how are we going to top that? And I put this unnecessary, one of the, in our No Fear course, KNOW, No Fear, we talk about fear as an acronym as false expectations appearing real. I'm visualizing on a future event that's causing me stress in the present. I don't need that stress. But you, unless you have the self-awareness to recognize you're doing that, the changes in that energy is contagious. And everyone's looking to you for leadership, right? And me, and it's like, but what I realized very quickly is that you use the term, how am I going to recreate what we did last year? And I suggest moving forward, you go, how are we going to reinvent ourselves for next year? What are we going to do? What are we going to, you know, there's things that we know are great. Like, we're not going to change our autograph photo protocol. And I watched that when my buddy Jason Redman did it. And I was watching your team, the, you know, lights, action, camera, moving, shuffling out this way, boom. And I'm going, holy shit.
I have a great team. I have, honestly, we just had a conversation with one of the girls here yesterday. I said, you know, you all, you know, suffer some anxiety when I have to make some adjustments on this team at times. And I said, but at the same time, you're always telling me everybody's so perfect here. It's so great. I go, because I got to do a lot of dirty work and I don't mean to do it. It's just that if you would like it to feel this way, if you'd like this level of comfort, this level of efficiency, I have to make decisions to keep it this way. And, you know, sometimes they're not popular, but, and she said to me, I didn't always understand, but I understand it now.
Yeah, it's very good. Anyways, you're doing a great job. But just think about reinventing, because now you're letting go of, you know, it's like you break up with your girlfriend, you go, I'll never find anyone like her. And then your next girlfriend, you're like, oh my God, who? I don't even remember. Like, you'll That's always, right. you'll always, in your case, obviously boyfriend, but
I like you slipped that one in there.
Right, I slipped it in. And a beautiful psycho dog. Say hi.
It's funny. You talked about my. I wouldn't be surprised if you pan this camera. And you have empty jars of peanut butter with six dogs everywhere.
it's nuts. And this little nutcase jumped the fence a little while ago and mauled a dog on the other side. It was awful.
What'd that cost you?
Fortunately, we had insurance minus deductible, but it was about $14,000 in repairs to the dog.
Yeah, but, I'm sure.
Awful. You know, it's so funny because we've got beware of dogs and we've got protection dogs. And there's this one guy, I'd seen him before. He would stop on his phone, like right by, we've got like a property in the sort of in the pseudo suburb hills. And so it's not really suburban. And we've got signs and there's six dogs and they always friggin' alert when people walk by. And this one guy always would stop on his phone with this little dog and the dog would bark like crazy and he'd be standing there. And I'm like, I'd hear the dog is going, and I'd go, and I would think, because I'm on a hill, I'd see him and I'd go, like, why would you stop when I'm on a walk? If I walk by somebody's house and their dog's going nuts, I don't stop in front of the gate, in front of the door and go, it's okay. Like, I just fucking keep moving. I get what the dog's doing. It's a dog. You know, it's so funny. We, you know, someone ring the doorbell and the dog's barking and like the kids in the house are like, Bowie, quiet, Ace, quiet. They're dogs. They bark at the door. That's their job. I know you want them to be quiet, but anyways.
Let me just say this. I don't want people to get the, fall under the impression that I get pressured. I already have what it looks like at the next conference in my head, and maybe not top it. I will tweak some things, but certainly recreate it and recreate a new experience in the sense that we're not going to have overlapping topics. So if you repeat every year, it'll feel different. We won't have overlapping. Right. We had Tommy Lahren for several reasons a second time, but you know, one of those reasons was she's native to Nashville, and she is a friend of the company, and I respect her as she respects me. And that respect continues to grow with one another. And so outside of that, and I've told some of my friends, and I don't want to say names, who are some of your keynote speakers that I am friends with personally, you know, hey, look, I don't want you to take offense to the fact that I'm not going to have you again at a conference, because that's not how business works. Sure. I've also realized that when I'm choosing keynote speakers, I have to remember that it's not about me. It's about who people want the most. So there are people that I find that are my heroes, but they're not
right.
The heroes of our general audience. So I keep right. that in mind. And, you know, there's a lot of, it's an interesting business dynamic, but overall, yes, we are trying to get as many people as possible. But I don't think we lose any of the essence. So I had a guy say to me, he goes, you know, feels like there's like not a lot of camaraderie at the moment with people. You don't have like an event where everybody can go to and socialize. And I said, well, first of all, we had a Sunday night soiree here. And a lot of people, I mean, we probably had 500-600 people at that event. That would have been your opportunity. And if you're in your shell and you're not being, you know, if you're being introspected and not being somebody who is out and shaking hands, saying hello, I can't be that for you. I'm not your kindergarten teacher. This isn't your first day of kindergarten. I said, two, where would you like me to bring 1,500 people to fucking hang out? Just where would you like it? Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well. You can't have 1,500 people anywhere unless it's Madison Square Garden. And that's obviously an exaggeration because it could hold more than that. But, you know, the idea is you do have downtime. You do have break time. Use that. But don't forget, I didn't run this thing so you could chop it up and make three buddies in Missouri.
Right.
That's on you to take the opportunity while you're here to find three buddies in Missouri. And a lot of people did find newfound friendships, which is a wonderful thing to see. And it's part of the deal of going there. But I don't have time to waste in the sense that I know that your money and your time is very precious and you're expecting from this company a big bang for your buck. And I've got to deliver on that. And some of those things that we have to do is I can't have 300 people at a conference and you want to have seven of the most significant keynote speakers in the country show up. Right. So we have to have 1,500, 2,000, 2,500, 3,000 people. The more people that show up, the bigger names I'm going to get. And I'll tell you off camera who we're already talking about and talking to. And we're going to blow people's fucking minds. The next lineup's going to be, they're just going to be, if you thought the last guys were great, which they were.
Right.
Don't, you know, and everybody knows this at this point now. I'm doing this 10 years. Don't sleep on us because we're going to hit this shit out of the park.
Nice. Nice. And no, it's exciting. I see that. You'll get to the point, man, where it's funny you use the term air traffic controller because that's how I've described my role many times at these things. But the last three big events, and again, the stress, the logistics, the dynamics are the same. I still got to fly people in from all over the world. I got to get a hotel. I got to do that. It's just your stuff's 10 times bigger. But the spreadsheet and the stress in your mind is the same. And my last three events, I've gotten my team around where they go, give us a theme. Are we having any special guests that we need to plan for? And then they're just showing me things and running things where because our stuff's hands-on, as well as lecture, I'm doing certain lectures and certain teaching blocks. They'll say, you know, hey, on Saturday, we don't need you in until 11 o'clock. And I'm like, really? Okay. But like, shouldn't I like say hello in the morning? You can come in if you want, but we're good. Like, and I'm like, holy shit. Like I could not show up and the event will still go. People will go, where's Tony? But it'll get to that point where you don't feel like you're like running around like the air traffic control, you know? And, you know, just like I said, if that was your second event, I was even more blown away.
Yeah. You know what? It's so funny that you bring that up too, because this event, in the beginning, I knew I had to adjust dials pretty quickly. Even on Sunday, I was changing music, making it louder, changing lights, doing this, doing that. And then one of our guys, so my assistant Karen said to me, Tommy Brooks wants, he said he would be a dream of his to MC the event. And I said, so tell him to do it tomorrow. And then him and one of our other guys, Kenny Williams, who's the Red Ninja, I don't know if you were there for that day, but they put on this skit on Thursday, I think, or into Friday. I let them host the day, and I was told I wasn't there because I stayed in and tried to recoup a little bit. Thursday was the night that I decided to go out.
Right.
And I've been told the skit was hysterical. And I said, you know, next year, I'll host here and there, but I'm going to let the other instructors have their opportunity to host the event, because I think it's wonderful that they wanted to do it. And what a gift I'm able to give to them if that's what they really wanted to do. And I am certainly somebody that, if you know me well, you know I have a lot of humility and not a lot of hubris. And I just said, yeah, let's do it. Like, I'm just open to everything. I'm like, let it rock, man. You know, everybody knows who I am. I don't have to prove it. Who's here, at least, you know, in some sense. And the one thing that's wonderful about the Street Cop Conference is some people get sent there. Some people come there. But the best thing is I think by the time everybody leaves, everybody's a believer. So if the 300 people that showed up, they didn't know much about us. And we could see that on the back end, because we got hundreds of people joining our Facebook group. And it says at the bottom when they're, because they have questions that ask, you know, I went to your 2023 conference. It was fantastic. I want to do, I've had calls, people going, you know, listen, I got your number. I want to talk to you. I was somebody who was a pessimistic street cop person. I didn't believe in what you did. I didn't like you. Man, I got to tell you, I was fucking wrong. And I'm sorry about that. There's always room on this team for another believer. And we don't hold any animosity. I don't live in the past. And we even have instructors here who will tell you that they hated my guts when they first found out about me. And they're now working for the company.
Nice. That's wonderful, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And because with people starting to know us, I mean, we really are authentically good people. And I hang my hat on that. I just know that no matter where I go, you're never going to pull something out of the closet that's going to be a skeleton that I don't want to face. At least not in business, right? You're not going to say to me like, well, there was this time you didn't pay this guy $1,500 and you owed him. No, there's not. You'll never, ever hear of a story of me ever fucking somebody over in business. It's just not how I will never do it. I would literally lose this whole business before I screwed somebody over.
Yeah. No, it's very cool, man. I'm like I told you at the event, you know, there's your energy's infectious. And you're doing freaking wicked things. I mean, I don't know, with a group that size, it's near impossible to have breakout sessions where people can have more intimate exchanges with people. That'd be like, if you said to me, what would you like to see? I'd go, you know, hey, wouldn't it have been cool if there were like 30 people in a room with Jason or O'Neill or, you know, just like a little track on, you know, coming in a door with a gun with a guy who had done this, even though the tactics might have changed. But how do you do that with 1,500 people, right?
You can't.
We
even tried to do like, so it was hard. We brought trapped cars in. So they're electronically hidden compartments built into cars by, you know, on aftermarket parts to conceal contraband and use it to move it across the country and, you know, internationally, whatever it may be. And the first conference, we brought like three of these cars in, and Brad Gilmore, who's our trap guy, and we have another trap guy as well, Jeremy Bedingfield now. We had 900 and almost 1,000 people at the first conference. And, you know, it was even hard to cycle them through just the experience of getting around the car. Sure. And so I said, this year, we'll just have to forego it. You just won't be able to. There's some things you'll be able to do and some things that you won't. And we learned lessons. Like, we had we want to do something special for everybody. So we had a private event for 110 people, because that's all we really had the money to do it for an open bar in downtown on a private terrace. And it was cool. It was super expensive and it wasn't worth it. So I just said, you know, next year, and I don't mean that it was worth it in the sense of like, it wasn't a fun time. It was a fun time. You know, I said to Kenny Williams, who's, you know, our instructor here, I said, you know, next year we can just pick a place and make it private instead of making it open bar. I don't think anybody really cared about maybe spending $30-$40 because nobody drank enough to get $10,000 worth of alcohol out of it in 3 hours. It just wasn't, we're just not drinking that much. So maybe next year we rethink that. And that's part of doing business. You try it. It was good. And everything can just be done better. And we could probably have a better event. We actually have a country music star who wants to work with us now. He's actually and I can't reveal that yet, but it's been told that he wants to be a part of it. And he wants to come and entertain everybody. And he's a well-known Grammy-winning country music star. Yeah. So, and he's, you know, they're like, the question was like, how do I fit in? And I'm like, well, let me think about how we can do this and maybe do something really special. And I don't think it's on the break. You take your guitar out or we cut an hour off the block and you sit there and sing on your guitar. I think it's maybe something off campus. I don't know. I got to think about it. I think about how it's going to really piece in nicely.
Nice. Very, very cool.
Yeah, man. And hopefully you can get to the next one too. If you're if you don't break a hip by then or something.
Dude. I'll wheel there. Wheelchair. No, I'm still moving around, moving pretty good, staying in pretty good shape. I had a in Nashville, I don't know if you know this, you should, but maybe you don't. It's mandatory that you get carded. You card everybody before they go into a bar. It doesn't matter their age. It's mandatory.
Yeah.
So I pride myself in, you know, I'm 63, May 2nd, 2 days ago. I'm in better shape than most men on the planet. I can still move. I can still protect myself, my family. So I walk up to this bar. I don't know this law. And I walk up to this Bourbon Street bar right near my hotel. And there's a Grammy Award winning band playing. And we're walking by from dinner. I go, oh, shit, let's go in here and have a beer. So I go to walk in, and this young guy, the doorman, goes, sorry, I need to see your ID. So I go, dude, look at my gray hair. Look at, seriously, you need my ID? Do I look that young? He said, it's the law. I said, I'll show you my ID if you can guess how old I am. And I'm thinking, like, because I pride myself in not looking my age. He looks at me, he goes, 62. I'm like, whoa, you motherfucker. Says 62. Wow. I go, you bastard. I take out my card. I go, I'm 62. I said, you owe me a fucking drink. He says, no, you owe me a drink. I guessed it, but I couldn't believe he said that.
Wow.
I'm sharing that because of your joke. If you don't break a hip by then, you can come to the conference. But
well, I wouldn't be so harsh on the jokes if you weren't taking shots at my sexuality.
Right. But
for the record, let's be very clear. One, I enjoy the banter, and that's why it's welcome, and Tony can make those remarks to me all the time. Number two, I very much like women a lot. I mean, and number three, and I will sit here and take a polygraph. There has never been a moment in my life. I just did this on the last podcast. I don't even know if dudes are good looking or not. I can't even tell.
Right.
I just can't. Like unless they're profoundly good looking. Like I look like these model dudes. I'm like, yeah, chicks probably want to hook up. That dude's, I have a friend of mine that my videography is for Michael Dean. If you ever want to look up Michael Dean, I think he was on some Bachelor show or some shit. Great guy. You look at this dude. There's no question about it. I mean, he's like literally the epitome of great looking. He's chiseled as shit. He's built like a brick shit house. And he's handsome. I mean, it's annoying how good looking he is. And girls here are like, he's beautiful. Right? That I could tell. I see that guy. I'm going, yeah, this guy, chicks must take this dude.
Bastard.
But sometimes I see guys and I hear girls like, oh, man, he's so good looking. Or he's so cute. Or he's so hot. And I'm like, him? Come on. Are you serious? That's the guy? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, and like other girls like, yeah, you don't think he's. I'm like, I mean, it's either you're really good looking or you're everybody else to me as a dude. I don't fucking know the difference.
You could just say he's not my type. Anyways.
That's pretty good, dude. I actually had a few questions for you here.
Fire.
And then we'll probably have to wrap pretty soon, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I think I'm doing your show next week, right?
I think so.
All right.
You'll
have to have questions for me there. Have you ever thought about retirement? What does it look like?
I don't think about that at all, man. I don't like getting old. I don't like, you know,
me I don't too.
Like
I don't either.
In my neck. I'm like, oh, shit. I lost my mom during the pandemic. My dad died 7 years ago. My brain's going, ah, fuck you. I'm always doing something new. Like we created so many new things to get through the pandemic that while we were building them, when they were done, I was like, we could have had this in our business before the pandemic. So it had nothing to do with the pandemic. How come we didn't have these courses set up like this? Why didn't we do this or that? Blah, blah, blah. And so the most fun I have is when I'm coaching, when I'm teaching, when I'm training. And as my, like, there's an organization in Australia that flies me over. That hasn't happened in a couple of years because of how the world changed, but would fly me over 2-3 times a year just to talk to 7 of their instructors for a week. And I would sit there, I'll show you privately because of the organization, like like whiteboards, just like mad scientist Albert Einstein whiteboards on scenario design, the connection between neurobiology, physiology, kinesiology, and psychology, why people miss gunshots, why people fuck up scenario-based training, why, because I've been studying violence and fear for 40 years, trying to figure out what's the riddle. And there are things even to this day in defensive tactics and combatives that's still not understood or looked at. And the just as simple as, and so there are certain people in certain elements at, so we did something for a group in the Navy that they've got discretionary funds, that they've got like human performance experts, like lab coat people in there assessing training, where they bring me in to talk, and they've got these people there, plus the operators, plus the, and I'm explaining, if you're working on something that too much, that you're creating a romantic dopamine relationship with that movement pattern, the neural pattern, because there's no such thing in the real world as muscle memory. Muscles don't have the capacity to store memory, but you have a neural pattern that can compromise your functioning situational awareness. And people are like, what the fuck are you talking about? So all that's like, most people are going, I have no idea what you just said. Punch me in the face, right? It's, but there are people going out there, wait a minute, what did you just say? Yeah, I do this move over and over again, and I create a dopamine relationship with the success of me making that move happen. And then what I do is I create a neural pattern that defaults, just like Pavlov's dog, ring a bell, salivate. And now I'm in a confrontation where maybe I should step to the right, or I should push the guy and run, or should go for hard cover. But my move that I love is unconsciously calling me. So if you're a boxer and that's your thing, and you're standing there, and you go, and he's, the guy's like posturing, and you go, hey man, listen, you're inside a reactionary gap, blah, blah. But you're a boxer. You're only thinking about, if this guy tries anything, I'm going to fucking hit him with a body shot and then I'll hit him uppercut. You're not going to be thinking about a side kick or a double leg or shooting him, because unconsciously your love of that element can override like the functional situational awareness of what is the safest, most moral, ethical, legal thing to do here, force must parallel danger. And so we've created kind of conversations and protocols around that, and then figured out a way to insert that into scenarios and train people on how to do evidence-based scenario training. So that was like a crazy, insane answer to, so what do you think about retiring? Like, are you thinking about retiring? And my brain is always at that level computing, so I can be talking to people, you know, on a video call overseas about their scenario design for the next year with their training cadre, to, you know, someone talking to me about like tactical fitness and what's practical, what's impractical. So I don't know, like right now, I've never woken up, Dennis, and said, I have no idea what to say today, or I don't know what I'm thinking about. It's always like, I wish I had more money to do this project, or I wish I had more time. I got a concept I want to do at Force Science Institute at Stanford with heart rate variability measurements and scenario design, and like just things that just keep morphing. So I don't fucking know. So no, the answer is no.
Four letters that keep floating in my head every time you talk is ADHD. Because, and it's, I'll have you know this. I joined a mastermind group, and it's all founders and people who are entrepreneurs, and believe me, they are hitters, brother. I mean, it's, you want to come have a slice of humble pie with me, I'll bring you to one of those meetings, because then you sure think you're hot shit until you sit down with people who are just have it way more figured out, some of them much younger than you as well. And that was actually brought up. It's very interesting that everybody in this room and people say they suffer from ADHD. I actually think it's just the opposite. I think you're suffering if you don't have it, because right. I think that ADD or ADHD is the formula for success. And they put these kids into these school systems with this and give them a diagnosis and try to medicate them to calm that down.
Right.
What you're not realizing, you stupid fucks, is this is the magic. This is where the superpower right. is. And I see that a lot in you as you're speaking with me, because that brain never shuts off. I have the same problem, and I'm sure anybody who's doing what we're doing sure. has the same thing. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. No, I love it. There's a lot of... Yeah, I don't want my ADHD to fucking hijack that and everything, but yeah, there are certain people that see the world differently and they think differently, and then people who don't understand that have to create a label or judge them or go you're different. It's like the Steve Jobs Think Different campaign, right? It's the people who think differently change the world.
There's nothing that breaks my heart more knowing that ADHD and ADD is my superpower. And again, you got to learn how to corral it and work with it.
Sure.
When a parent who's a fucking idiot will medicate their child to try to get them to fit into a school system that's completely flawed and broken. Yes. Because they're fucking idiots themselves. And I hate seeing me and how I grew up, right? You're so smart. Why don't you have good grades? It's because this place is a fucking joke. And I know it, even though I'm 9, right? Like, I know right. This is bullshit and this is not creative at all. And it's interesting. My, I talked about this on the podcast, I think recently. We were driving and my oldest said to me, what's GNT, Dad? And in the United States, or at least New Jersey, it's called gifted and talented.
Okay.
And he said, there's a few kids in my class that go to GNT. He goes, they're smart, right? And I said, I'm going to tell you something right now. There were many kids in my class. I remember being third grade and not being selected for GNT, but knowing I was very, very smart. At that time, at least I thought I was. And I said, so I tell him the story. I go, there's probably 7 kids in my class in third grade that went to GNT. And I'm sure the parents are proud. I'm sure they were excited. But your dad has become more successful than all those kids. And when we left, you can understand this at 9 going on 10. Nobody could have predicted what life would have been like 20, 25 years after business. I mean, after you graduated high school.
Sure.
Of where people would be. Nobody that I know to this day ended up where you thought they would have been. Not one person. I haven't met, okay, a couple guys in jail, a couple guys dead. Knew that was going to happen, right? That was clear. The writing was on the wall for that. Sure. But outside of those people, your honor society, you're gifted and talented, you're all these things, these straight A students, you would have thought, like I would, if I was them, I'd go back to the school system and say, hold on a second, you guys tricked me, right? I mean, I got straight A's. Well, how did I end up like this? How did I end up on the lower end of the spectrum in the economic scale? Like, and I'm not talking about happiness versus being unhappy. Money's not a variable. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, you were led to believe that A's and B's are going to equal Ferraris and Lamborghinis. But there's a saying, and there's a saying for a reason. Why do D students and C, why do A, B, A students and B students work for C students and D students? And there's a real reason behind it. I'm not saying that because I was a C and D student, which I was. I didn't even go to school. I barely went. I just had no interest in it. It was boring. It was like torture. It was prison for me. Same and here. If I see that in my children now, I'm very vocal about it. As soon as they're ready, and they want, this school system is beginning to damper their spirits and extinguish their glow. We're going to find plan B. And fortunately enough, their father has been working hard enough to have a plan B option. Mm-hmm. And I might have somebody just, I don't know what I would do, but as soon as they say, now I get it. My kids are like, I hate school. School sucks. I'm like, yeah, I tell every kid the same thing. I go, yeah, it's none of it's going to matter. It doesn't get any more fun. Right there. I have middle school kids in my neighborhood. They come to my house. I go, how's school? It's fucking terrible. I go, oh, it doesn't get any better. And they go, well, what about college? I go, sucks too, except you get to drink more. I go, all of it's bullshit too, by the way. You don't need, my wife's aunt was at at Christmas and her granddaughter is there. And I said, what grade are you in now? She goes, I'm going into 8th. I go, I thought you're going into high school. She goes, no, I'm going to 8th. I go, how's school? She's like, it's terrible. I go, here's the good news. It doesn't matter at all. None of it. None of this stuff matters at all. None of it. And of course, her grandmother steps in. Well, Bill, you need an education. You need an education. You need to go to college. And in my head, and I don't want to even say this publicly. In my head, I'm saying to myself, do I fight this battle? You know, because this is family now. And I know that the woman I'm married to is going to have a fit when she hears what I have to say. And I've had this battle 1,000 times. And I said, I'll just wait for her to leave. And so she left. And I said to her, you're in 8th grade. You're 13. You understand things. You're a young woman. You're a young adult. I have no college. And everybody in your family does, but I'm the only one who doesn't. And so I want you to think about this. Look at the house you're in right now and the things that we have, and look at the house that everybody else is in. And I'm not trying to sound like a dick. I'm trying to prove a point. Your grades and college is not the variable to your financial or spiritual success in life. And don't let anybody tell you. And if you're going to take advice from anybody, take advice from somebody who think actually knows the answer. So if you're going to take advice from somebody from about money, don't take advice from a person who has none.
Right.
That's it. I mean, yeah. I want to learn about meditation. I'm not going to the fucking 7-Eleven down the road and asking the guy at the counter, how do I meditate? I'm going to go find a woman who wrote a book on meditation and is a number one New York Times bestseller, aka Emily Fletcher, who's going on the podcast again, who was the woman I spent 4 days learning meditation from.
Nice.
Right. I'm going to sit and take advice from the friends of mine who are making $8 and $10 million a year on what to do with money. I'm going to go to Mykonos, Greece at the end of the month with these entrepreneurs that I'm going with and open my ears, sit down and listen. And I want to hear what they did that I don't know. Because if they're doing 30, 50 million a year, and I think everybody would want to do 30, 50 million a year with still keeping, of the a record or a control of who I am as a human being.
Sure.
Well, sure. Because people don't realize that when you talk about money like that, they're like, oh, that sounds really shitty, does it? Because what you don't realize is that there's nothing I love more to do than giving my money away and helping worthy causes. And there's nothing better than when somebody says, I'm down on my luck. Things have happened that I can go, I took some money out of my bank account for you. Here it is. And they go, you got to be kidding me. And I go, what do I owe you for this? Yeah. And dude, I mean, literally the woman at the gas station, we have full service pumps here. I mean, you know, I can tell she's a wonderful human being. She's a female pumping gas. And she must be from some kind of European country. I would guess Ukraine, and she might be a refugee. And she's working a gas station in the cold. And every time I go there, dude, I hit her for like 10 or 20 bucks as a tip. And she can't believe it.
Right.
She is flabbergasted every time. And, you know, I just can't emphasize to you what it feels like to do that for somebody else. That people just, and you can't do that if you don't have the means to do that. So when people say, oh, well, you know, it's all about a money thing. No, it's not. It actually isn't. It has nothing to do with the money. If you come to my house and you look around, you can say, it's a beautiful house. I'll say, show me one thing that's about me. Tell me one thing's about me. Oh, your gym in your basement. Really? Do you know why I built a gym in my basement? Here's the answer. One, I get to spend more time with my kids. They watch their father work out. Mm-hmm. I have more time to spend growing and developing this company for all the law enforcement officers in the country and other people as well who are listening and welcome to listen. So on the surface, it looks like it's very selfish, but it's actually very selfless to have done this. And yeah, there is some of me involved in that. I like the convenience of it as well. And I got to tell you, I've heard Jocko Willink say this and I want to repeat it. I don't know if there's a better investment that I've ever made in my life than the gym I built in the basement of my house. And I have Hammer Strength, Cybex, real nice stuff. And I use it nonstop. And I don't know if you can put a price on what your health and well-being.
Yeah, no. And it's, you know, you said the selfless, selfish play on words there. But there's also, without getting caught up in a semantic loop, being selfish, if you're not harming children or animals, is a great thing. You're an incredibly selfish man with your time, but it's look at the company and the team you've created by being selfish. Look at your physique. Look at the way you parent. Look at, we could argue that that's all selfish. I think most people have that negative connotation. The same thing with money. You know, there's that old expression, you know, money doesn't buy you happiness. And I would, when someone would say that to me, I'd go, well, if I'm going to be miserable, I want to be rich. So it's just this idea that it's an asset that you can do something for other people, for your company.
It can bring you happiness in the sense of what you can do with it for other people. I'm going to tell this last little excerpt. My brother-in-law, my sister-in-law are my two favorite people on earth. I just don't. They are the most amazing people, and they're young. They're 14 years younger than me. When I first met her, I had already known him for a couple of years. She was 19, and she's like, you know, money. She was raised on this idea that money is evil, and I said, it's not money that's evil. It's a lack of money that's evil. If you really look at that, it's really true. It's where people behave the most inappropriately when they feel the anxiety of money stress, and many marriages can't survive that stuff, and many divorces turn ugly because of money issues because there's not enough. And I said, you know, what would you want to do with your life? How many kids do you want to have? I said, well, I would like to have one child and then adopt one. I said, why do you want to adopt a child? And she said, well, I wanted to give a kid, a life and da-da-da, and I'm going to be a mother. And I said, that's fantastic. What a wonderful answer, but would you ever adopt two? Well, I would, but you know, who can afford three kids? I said, you're making my point now. Mm. If you made money, and this is why money is important, if you made money, you could adopt four or five kids comfortably, find help, leverage it out, and change five lives instead of one. And actually, she will tell you to this day, I should have her on the podcast, that is when she started seeing money differently, because she had not correlated her purpose of what a, she's a fantastic human being, very pretty, very funny. I love her, very non-judgmental. She's a fantastic human being. Everybody should hope in their life they meet a girl like that, like my sister-in-law, Abby, and have a brother-in-law like my brother-in-law, Steve. And she'll to this day say to me, that was it. That's when I really understood it. I correlated it back to something that meant something to her.
Sure.
She didn't give a fuck about a Lamborghini. And guess what? I don't either. But I can't tell you the look on somebody's face when you casually hand them a lump sum of money when they're in a shitty spot and they don't know what they're going to do. And you literally sent them a rescue boat. And, you know, it's not like I continuously throw the same line to the same person over and over again.
Sure.
But I'll give you one. I'll give you one right now. Tell them before we go. A very disabled older brother. If I didn't have financial success, he would be in a group home right now, not getting the care that he needs. Right. And I am able to pay for him to live his life in his own apartment with his own care. And he has a credit card with his name and my name on it and his caretakers. He goes to Atlantic City and enjoys casinos and goes out to dinner. He's significantly disabled. This is not somebody who is a loser. This is somebody who's born with retardation and gets to go live his life. And I said to my wife at times, what if I didn't take this path and go out and work this hard? What would it mean for just him alone? So I was able to take his situation and make it significantly better. And these are the big whys of why financial freedom and success is an important thing, because it's not about what you can buy and what you can do for yourself. Right? Like, there's the comfort I like as well, you know, not having to stress. That's an important thing, or like experiencing something faster and more comfortable than most people. But, I think the real high comes out of what I can do for other people and not ignoring what my potential actually is.
I love it, man. I love it. You're a good man.
Well, I think I am a good man in the sense that I'm just being me. I think I was born a good man, or I developed, I don't know, maybe my genetics led me, or how my brain was designed to follow people I thought were good men. And I really liked it. So I followed that. And people have set examples for me, but I'm now setting examples for others. And I don't pretend to be good. It's just my nature. For all the things that were wrong with my parents, I always thought they did for other people. They would always, without any question, help somebody else out. Now, the problem with them was once they did that for you, because they would drop everything to help you, you owed them. That was the problem. So they had one half of the equation right, but then the other side of the half was, don't worry, I'll be collecting what you owe me at some junction.
So somehow you have or cultivated the self-awareness to see the contradiction and do that, because you could very easily have been helping and said, hey, here's this 10 grand to get you out of that jam, but you got 3 months to pay me back or I'm gonna break your legs. Right. So, you know, it's very cool, man. It's very cool.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I will think we'll see you next week.
I think so. I don't know. Yeah, I got, I do like 2-3 podcasts a week sometimes. So I think you're coming up any minute now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll see you soon. So this is not goodbye. Just till next time.
Right.
And I bid you adieu, Mr. Blauer. Yeah.
Take care, buddy. Be safe.
I'll see you, buddy. Yep. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.